Michael Uslan, the executive producer of the Batman movies. It is great to be on Comic Book Central. Really enjoy your program. Think you're doing a top-notch job. Thanks so much. And that from the boy who loved Batman.
Welcome, Bat fans. This is Comic Book Central. I'm your host, Joe Stuber. Thanks for joining me here in the lair. As regular listeners know, we are in the midst of a year-long celebration of Batman's 75th anniversary. If you haven't had a chance to check out my previous Bat Conversations, head on over to the website comicbookcentral.net or subscribe and download them in iTunes. We've got the two Catwomen, animated and live action, Adrienne Barbeau on episode 19, Julie Newmar on episode 20. We've got Batman himself, Kevin Conroy. He was my guest for episode 21. And Mark Valley from The Dark Knight Returns joined me on episode 25. So again, if you haven't had a chance to listen to those conversations, check them out. You get to relive so many different eras of Batman. But don't go anywhere right now, not before you hear from my guest in the lair today. Oh, this has been a long time coming. One of my most sought-after guests will be along in a few minutes to not only celebrate Batman's 75th anniversary, we are going to celebrate the 25th anniversary of his Bat Project, one that took more than a decade of perseverance to pull off. The executive producer of the 1989 film Batman, Michael Uslan, is my guest today, and you are going to hear some amazing stories. I'll have that conversation shortly, but first, I want to remind everyone that I will be taking this show on the road in a few weeks. That's right, Comic Book Central will have a presence at the Connecticut Comic Con, August 15th through the 17th, at the Webster Bank Arena in Bridgeport, Connecticut.
Unleash your power when Connecticut Comic-Con hits the Webster Bank Arena. There'll be celebrity guests, legendary comic book creators, famous movies and TV vehicles. Shop for comics, collectibles, and cool stuff. Dress as your favorite character and enter costume contests for kids and adults. Meet your favorite voice actors and see a reunion of the cast of the Thundercats. Tickets on sale now, online, and at the arena box office. Join us on August 15th through 17th for Connecticut Comic-Con.
Yeah, I've got some details now on a few of the panels I'll be on. Friday, August 15th at 7:15 p.m., I will be a guest on the panel How to Do a Podcast. Now, Mitch Halleck, the convention coordinator, the organizer, the big cheese, he's asked me to be a part of this panel. I'm not sure if I'm going to be the how to do it part or how to not do it part. I guess we're going to find out together. But also on that panel, Mitch himself, he's going to be there. You may have heard us chatting over on the IndieCast, the world's number one Indiana Jones podcast. And another one of our IndieCast buddies will be joining us on that panel as well, Laird Malamed. Now, Laird was assistant sound editor on the Young Indiana Jones Chronicles back in the day, so he knows his indie stuff, and he knows his podcasting. So if you're at the convention, stop by, say hi, let's talk indie, let's talk comic books. Looking forward to meeting so many people there. Saturday, I'm going to be running around most of Saturday getting interviews for upcoming episodes of Comic Book Central. Hopefully, I'll get to run into Ray Park. That's right, Darth Maul from Star Wars, Toad from the X-Men, and Snake Eyes from G.I. Joe. Also, Maximiliano Hernandez from Captain America Winter Soldier. He's going to be there. Many others. I'm going to try and get as many interviews as I can. Then on Sunday at high noon, I will be moderating a Q&A session with none other than the greatest American hero, actor William Catt. Now, if you recall, I had a conversation with William back on episode 31 of Comic Book Central. We're going to talk about his films, the hit ABC show. We're going to find out what he's up to now, take some questions from the audience. If you have anything you'd like to ask William Catt, please send your questions in now. Send them in to me, joe@comicbookcentral.net. If you have any questions for Ray Park, Maximiliano Hernandez, anybody that's going to be at Comic-Con, send them to me. I'm going to do my best to work those into the sessions, the interviews that I'm going to be doing. It's going to be a blast. So get those to me, joe@comicbookcentral.net. I'll put them all together. I'm going to be doing my homework for Connecticut Comic-Con. It's going to be a blast. I'm sure I'm going to be exhausted when it's over. But I will bring back as much of the convention as I can get to you listeners in the weeks ahead. But if you can make it out to the show, even better yet, I'd love to meet you. Now on to today's show. Now, as I mentioned, this is a conversation I've been looking forward to for quite a while. I first met Michael Uslan several years ago at the Cincinnati Comic Expo. Now, full disclosure here, at the time when I thought of the 1989 Batman film, I immediately thought of Tim Burton and Michael Keaton. Now, that's completely understandable. It was Burton's twisted genius that permeated the film, and it was Keaton's intense, borderline psychotic portrayal of the Dark Knight that made such a huge impression. It went way beyond comic book fans. But after sitting in on Michael Uslan's presentation at the convention and hearing story after captivating story of how he tirelessly worked for over a decade to bring his vision of a Dark Knight detective to the screen, a time he calls the 10-year human endurance contest, I came to realize that this was the man to thank for the film. It would not have happened without him. Remember now, the only vision that people had of a live-action Batman was the Adam West TV series. Other than the Richard Donner Superman film, comic book characters were considered to be jokey. So when I heard how Michael dealt with a tremendous amount of discouragement along the way, I was actually inspired to view my personal challenges in a whole different way. The entire story is revealed by Michael in his book, The Boy Who Loved Batman. I highly recommend this book. It's a coming-of-age story. It's kind of like a comic book kid meets the Wonder Years, and so much more. I picked it up at the convention. Michael personally signed it for me. We had a chance to talk for a bit. And when I got home, I could not put the book down. And I was inspired even more as I read page after page. Some of those stories you're going to hear today on the show, trust me, you want to get this book. Take a quick listen to this. I'm going to be right back with The Boy Who Loved Batman and the man who, 25 years ago, brought us Batman, Michael Uslan. If you're looking for an authority on comic books, look no further than Michael Uslan. In fact, Michael was not only a huge comic book fan as a kid, he grew up to be the first person to teach an accredited college course on comic books. Now, how's that for historical perspective? A graduate of Indiana University School of Law, Michael had the skill set he needed to tackle the business end of show business, and reading comics, then writing comics for DC, put enough thoughts of superheroes in his head to fuel his creative side. Now was the time to put all that into practice. All along, Michael had one goal: bring the iconic character of the Batman, the one created by Bob Kane and Bill Finger way back in 1939, the Dark Knight, the avenging hero of the night, bring that character to the silver screen. Well, easier said than done. Sure, it's a no-brainer now, 7 Batman films in and an 8th with Ben Affleck on the way. But in the late 70s, holy campy TV show, people were still thinking of Adam West and the Bat-Toosie. Well, along the way to Batman, Michael honed his Hollywood skills with the cult classic Swamp Thing feature film and the animated series Dino Saucers. But on one fateful day in the late 80s, the day he dreamed about finally arrived. The bat phone rang, the bat signal flared, and Michael Uslan, along with visionary director Tim Burton and Hollywood hotshots Jack Nicholson and Michael Keaton, changed the face of comic book movies forever. Well, I'm not planning on it, but I can tell you listeners that I could easily do a 5-part series based solely on the work of my guest today. He is not only responsible for bringing the 1989 Batman film to the screen, he is responsible for the Batman film universe as we know it. Holy silver anniversary, it is an honor to welcome Bat producer Michael Uslan to the show. Michael, welcome to Comic Book Central.
Joe, thanks so much. It's a pleasure to be here, especially on such an historic week. The 25th anniversary of our first Batman film. I cannot believe it.
I can't believe it. I feel really old now. I love this movie.
You and me both. You know, it's funny. In the 10 years it took me to get the first Batman movie made from the time that my partner Ben Melnicker and I got the rights, it seemed like every day was an eternity. The time moves so slowly, and now, 25 years later, it's like it's moved in a flash. It's really been some ride.
And you're still talking about it, and it's really informed everything that has come after it. I mean, it really has. We'll talk a little bit about the story, get into it. If people aren't familiar with the story, they're going to love it. It's fantastic. I have to ask, first off, what was your favorite bat toy or bat collectible as a kid?
Well, you got to understand, I'm ancient. And back then, it was so utterly rare to find any kind of toy item that had anything whatsoever to do with comic book characters. When I was growing up, the only thing out of comic books that made it to TV was The Adventures of Superman with George Reeves and Sheena, Queen of the Jungle. That was it until the Batman TV series came on the air.
Is that Irish McCallum? Was that?
Yeah, Irish McCalla.
Yeah.
It was a barren landscape. The one comic book toy I remember getting as a kid was a plastic Superman in flight, and it had a little drop-down notch, and you would take it on a big giant slingshot and pull it back, and you could have Superman soaring through the air. That was the one and only superhero-related thing I found as a kid.
I'm sure it wouldn't even be marked as safe today, a flying projectile.
Yeah, maybe not, but it'll probably put one of my kids through school at this point. Who knows?
That's true. Mine was the Mego Batcave. That was my favorite. I had to have the Mego Batcave, and I had the Mego Batcave. I want to mention your book, The Boy Who Loved Batman. It is a fantastic read. And in it, you tell the entire story of how you brought The Dark Knight to the screen. It all started when you were a little boy. How old were you when you first became aware of Batman, and what was your fascination with the character?
I was 5 when I first saw Batman in a candy store on top of a rack. And to be honest, it scared me. I remember the cover, and it had a picture of an armored assault tank version of the Batmobile. I wonder if that impression stuck on my mind for years. And at age 5,
that sounds familiar.
I moved away from that and searched for Sugar and Spike, Richie Rich, Casper, and then Archie. And finally, I really graduated into Superman. And the main reason for that was Superman was on TV, and the comic books were safe and friendly. And it wasn't until I was a much more mature and sophisticated 8 years old that I became a regular reader of Batman.
What was what brought you back to the character? Had they? Because I know those early issues. I think he even was packing heat in some of those early issues. Gravitated away from that.
Yeah, in 1939 he was, before Robin entered the scene.
Right.
It was a rough and tumble pulp oriented kind of character that was more directly related to the Shadow and some of the pulp figures than anything. But he evolved. He definitely did evolve. So when I started actually reading every issue of Batman beginning in 1959, that for me opened up a new universe for mainly 3 reasons that I can recall. Number one, oh my God, this guy has no superpowers, and he's a superhero. I could do this. I could be this guy. The sense of identification was something I never could find in Superman or the Hulk or so many other characters. Number two, his origin story absolutely, totally creeped me out. I mean, imagine being 8 or 10 and reading a story about your parents being murdered before your eyes when you don't even stop to really think that maybe one day your parents won't be here. It was traumatizing, but boy, did it hit me in the gut. The third thing was, Batman had the greatest supervillains in the history of comics. And there's no way you can base the popularity and longevity of a comic book hero on anything but the quality of his villains. And Batman shone in that. And maybe the added bonus was the car.
What I was going to add. That was my introduction to the character. Obviously, the Adam West TV series for me. A little bit after that, I caught the syndicated versions of it, but yeah, he had the cool car. But you have a decidedly different view, or some different memories of the Adam West show, correct?
I do, Joe, and we have to really relate this story in terms of the context of the time. You know, I said before, there was nothing on TV from comics since The Adventures of Superman and Sheena. And now, there was nobody in the world, I would say, who was more excited about Batman coming to TV. That night in January 66, when the show came on, as I've said in my book, I was simultaneously thrilled and horrified. I was thrilled. It was on. It was in color. The opening credits were in animation. It was cool. The car was great. The sets were expensive. but I was horrified because I realized that the whole world was laughing at Batman, that he was being treated as a joke, and that's what killed me. And the reason it killed me was there was no other reference point for Batman in the world. Yeah, there were those of us fanboy geeks who were reading the comic books, but to the world at large, all they knew from and would know from for decades was the silly, funny, pow, zap, wham, pot-bellied Batman doing the Bat-toosie. And when I thought about how this was created by Bob Kane and Bill Finger in 39 as a creature of the night stalking criminals from the shadows, that night I had my own young Bruce Wayne vow moment. He made his vow over his parents' bloody corpses. I made mine over the TV series with my parents safe in the kitchen upstairs. But I vowed
such that a different
somehow,
view of this.
I vowed some way, someday, I would show the world the true Batman, a dark and serious Batman, and I would attempt to erase from the world consciousness those three words that were haunting me from January 66 on, pow, zap, and wham.
And Cesar Romero's mustache.
Oh, God, don't get me started.
Oh, my goodness. Well, you know, it just, yeah, that did infuse the character, and it was so huge at the time. But I mean, we can kind of Monday morning quarterback this now and look back and go, you know, at least it kept it in the public's collective consciousness. At least it defined the time and kept the character alive too.
Yeah, but even today, trying to come up with to find a newspaper or magazine article or a lead-in story on the news about comics or Batman that doesn't start with the word pow is very hard to do.
I did it. I did it to you. I gave you Holy Silver Anniversary. Look, now I feel bad.
That's quite all right. I'm from New Jersey. I have people who take care of this.
Oh, my. No, but, don't start the car, right?
But in truth, that today I welcome it. Today I absolutely embrace and welcome the show because it is not now the only cultural reference to Batman. Now the world has seen the dark and serious Batman. They've seen the Batman animated show. It's good to have other versions of Batman that are kid-friendly, that can help bring children into the Batman world so that as they grow older, they can then access the video games, the cartoons, and the movies. That's a good thing. It's also a good thing when every once in a while there's a pause on the dark Batman animated series and they do a Batman Brave and Bold to appeal to kids. So now I welcome it because it is not simply the only thing that's out there.
There's a Batman for everybody, and you are one of the men we have to thank for that. Speaking of comic books, I got a chance to hear you speak at a panel at the Cincinnati Comic Expo a few years back. You told a tragic tale to those that were gathered, one that is familiar to older comic book collectors everywhere. What happened to your original comic book collection?
Well, that actually was my partner's, Bobby Klein. Bobby's comic book collection, circa 1963, was shoveled into the fireplace.
I was thinking that was your comic book collection.
Well, Bobby and I joined our comic book collection.
Okay.
Ultimately, so the fallout, I should say the ash from this, did have an impact on me. But you have to understand, when Bobby and I were growing up, the world at large, meaning teachers, educators, administrators, clergy, and parents, largely had bought hook, line, and sinker into the Frederick Wortham Seduction of the Innocent doctrine that comic books were bad for kids, that they were lurid and cheap entertainment that potentially turned us into a generation of juvenile delinquents. And, of course, Wortham's favorite statement was that comic books caused asthma because children were staying indoors to read them instead of playing in the fresh air. But they bought this. So most of my friends were not permitted to bring comics in their house, and if their parents found comics, they were either given away on paper drives, thrown in the trash, or burned. There were comic book burnings that were going on. And if it wasn't for the advent of rock and roll and Elvis Presley, which took the spotlight away from comic books and put it over there, where they started to do record burnings, comic books might not exist today. So it was a different world. I have to tell you just the post-anecdote to this. Bobby's son got married a few years ago. We were at his wedding, and His mom was there, and we were sitting down, and we started to compute the value today of those comic books that were shoveled into the fireplace. And I think ultimately it was close to what today would be $2 million worth of comics.
Oh, that is truly painful. What was in that collection? Do you remember a few of the highlights?
I wake up screaming periodically.
You're going to give me nightmares now.
Amazing Fantasy 15.
Oh, yeah.
The first 12 issues of Spider-Man. The first maybe 17, 18 issues of Fantastic Four. The first maybe four or five Avengers. First four or five X-Men. Maybe Daredevil number one. And that doesn't even get into the DCs, which would have included the first appearances of Flash and Green Lantern and Justice League, Martian Manhunter.
You're killing us.
Do you want me to go on or do you want
me to start crying now? No, I'm just depressed now. Let's put a positive spin on this, though. But you went back and recollected 30,000 comics? Did I get that right?
I didn't recollect. I collected. Because, again, you have to go back to the time.
Yeah.
This was before internet. This was before Comic-Cons. So collecting comic books was about the most isolating hobby in the world. Until fifth grade, I thought I was the only person on earth that was so into comics until I met Bobby. And then we thought we're the only two kids until comic book fandom began to form around 1962, 63. And then we got into that. We started to subscribe to fanzines. We started to write for fanzines. And then he and I attended the first Comic-Con held on the planet Earth 50 years ago next week in downtown New York.
Oh, nice.
And there were 200 of us that showed up for the first Comic-Con, and we found 198 other people just like us that we were able to meet face-to-face, pimple to pimple, and enjoy the comic book experience, and that was a game-changer for us. So I was buying them off the stands at 10 cents and then 12 cents a piece. But because at that point in time, nobody knew that there were geeks like us who would pay money for old comics, we had a backdate magazine stand at a local flea market, and every Friday night the guy would come in with box after box of old comics that he would dump out on an old card table. And because these comic books were so old, he charged a nickel apiece for them, since they weren't worth face value. And that, Joe, is where I really amassed the bulk of my collection. By high school, I had over 30,000 comic books. Mm-hmm. It took up my parents' entire garage. And it dated back to 1936. And I picked up for a nickel apiece Mad 1 through 23, Superman 2, Archie 2, first Captain Marvel, first Plastic Man, filled in my entire Marvel Atlas collection. It was the day that could no longer be.
I said I could do a five-part series on you. That would take up one of the episodes alone. Let's put a postscript on this. Where are those comic books now? This is a great aspect of it.
As of today, I have donated 45,000 comic books from my collection to Indiana University's Lilly Library, which is its rare book library. They are sensational people. They really care about all of this. They have ongoing exhibitions. In fact, they have an exhibition right now, if you're anywhere near Bloomington, Indiana, using my collection to celebrate the 75th anniversary of Batman. And they do a wonderful, wonderful job. The icing on the cake for me was walking in there at the premier party for my collection, and they have an original Gutenberg Bible, an original Gilbert Stuart George Washington portrait, and then Batman number one. Okay, that to me is
sign
geek
me up.
Heaven.
Sign me up.
Yep.
Sign me up. Speaking of Indiana University, are you the coolest teacher ever?
Am I the coolest teacher ever? I am the most out-of-the-box weird teacher ever.
That makes you the coolest teacher ever. Let's talk about one of the greatest college courses in history, at least as far as comic book lovers go. This is our early 70s?
Yeah, this was 1972. And it was the College of Arts and Sciences had started an experimental curriculum department. And if you had an idea for a course that had never been taught anywhere, had the backing of a department on campus for it, you then could appear before a panel of deans and professors to pitch your course. If they accepted it, then you could teach it on campus for up to 3 hours of credit. So I used that opportunity to design a course on comic books, the first ever, what would be the first ever accredited college course on comic books. And I came at it several different ways. One, primarily the comics are an American art form, as indigenous to this country as jazz, and we're deserving of that recognition. Number two, that comic book superheroes were our contemporary mythology. It's all modern-day folklore. My theory being that the ancient gods of Greece, Rome, and Egypt all still exist today, except now they wear spandex and capes. And the folklore department agreed with me wholeheartedly. I then appeared before this panel of deans and professors in my Spider-Man t-shirt with a pile of Superman books under my arm.
Coolest teacher ever.
And the dean let me speak for 2 minutes before he cut me off and said, "Mr. Uslan, stop, I don't buy any of this." He says, "Come on, I read Superman comics when I was a kid. All they are is cheap entertainment for children. I don't accept anything about art, mythology, folklore." And in a life-changing moment, Joe, where I could have bowed my head, picked up my comics, and turned around and walked out of the room, I looked at the dean and I said, "May I ask you two questions?" He says, "Ask me anything you want." I said, "Are you familiar with the story of Moses?" And he looked at me like I was nuts. He goes, "Yeah." I go, "Could you very briefly just summarize for me the story of Moses?" And he folds his hands and he sits back and he goes, "Mr. Uslan, I don't know what game you're playing here, but I can play this with you. Hebrew people were being persecuted. Their firstborn were being slain. A Hebrew couple placed their infant son in a little wicker basket and sent him down the River Nile. There he's discovered by an Egyptian family that raises him as their own son. When he grows up and learns of his true heritage, he becomes a great hero to the Hebrew people." I go, "Stop, Dean. Thank you so much. That was great." I said, "You mentioned before you read Superman when you were a kid. Do you remember the origin of Superman?" He said, "Of course. The planet Krypton was about to blow up. A scientist and his wife placed their infant son in a little rocket ship and sent him to Earth. There he's discovered by the Kents, who raise him as their own son. When he grows up," and then he stops, stares at me for what I will forever swear to you was an eternity, and says, "Your course is accredited." And that's how he became the world's first ever college professor of comic books.
I love that story. It's in the book. Go get the book. You got to get the book. We should mention, though, you were going to law school at the time, too, right?
No, I was still undergrad at that time.
Okay.
I was still in undergrad.
But you had a legal mind. You knew how to debate.
No, I did not yet have a legal mind, but what I was a college campus oldies disc jockey, so I knew how to talk. And I was
so the legal mind fell into place because of you. Nice. Even better.
And I got my education from comic books, from Julie Schwartz's Flash Facts that
even
were in Flash every month.
And Edugraphics? Wasn't that when you were breaking into DC teaching kids how to read through comic books?
It was. It was a terrific program when I got my first job at DC. We wound up using Superman, Batman, and Wonder Woman to teach learning disabled children to read, to teach English as a second language students to read, to motivate slow readers to read. And ultimately, we sold that program to the New York City Board of Education as a supplemental reading program. And in order to maintain my qualifications, I was speaking at teachers' conventions and things, I went back and I got my master's degree in urban education.
Great stuff. Great stuff. This is the time that we're kind of looking at now. We're heading into this sort of decade-long, maybe even longer, a journey of bringing The Dark Knight to the screen. I'm kind of curious, though, what impact, if any, did Richard Donner's Superman have on the process?
It was landmark. Dick's work is spectacular and important for what happened. Hiring Marlon Brando to bring credibility to the concept of the comic book superhero blockbuster. Critical. The vision for a reimagining of Krypton in a new and exciting way. The seriousness of the Smallville sequences. Incredible. And in Superman number two, the way the villains were handled so well. These were all great things that were contributed. One thing that was different was in the first movie, the second he puts on the costume and is in Metropolis, the tone changes. It's very light. There's a lot of funny stuff going on. But Dick blazed the path. And then in 1989, thanks to Tim Burton and Anton Furst in particular, we were able to then do the first truly dark and serious comic book superhero movie. And that, in its tone, in its vision, in its design work, in its soundtrack, I believe continues to influence every single genre picture made even today. And it not only was so important and news at the box office, what's more important, it was a game changer in its cultural impact around the world. Life was never quite the same again. It blazed the path for all kinds of new comic book characters and graphic novels, ultimately, to come to the screen and be considered as adult fare, be taken seriously, and that changed everything. It changed the comic book. It changed the comic book industry. It changed the movie industry. Somewhat to my chagrin, I guess, is you know, in 2014, if you look at the top 12 grossing pictures of the year, half of them are comic book movies. And, you know, you throw in the animated 3Ds and the sci-fi genre stuff that's related to us, and that pretty much takes care of the whole list.
Yeah, that's what we're all about here at Comic Book Central. And it was around that time, too, that, I mean, they really did go from funny books to graphic novels and being taken seriously.
Yeah, because you have to add in what took place in 1986 in the comic book
Absolutely.
World, specifically The Dark Knight Returns and The Watchmen.
Mm-hmm.
And when you add that to our Batman movie, everybody, for the first time, in terms of the general public around the world, said, "Oh my God, you mean these things are no longer for 8 to 12-year-old boys?" And that was one of the aspects that made it a game changer.
Yeah, exactly. And so during that 10-year process then, what were some of the challenges that you faced and how did you overcome them?
Surviving, eating. These were some of the challenges I had in those 10 years from the time we bought the rights to the time we got the first film made. Every studio in Hollywood said no. They told me I was crazy. It was the worst idea they ever heard. Every door slammed in my face. They said, "Are you kidding? You can't do serious comic book movies. You can't do dark superheroes. You can't make a movie out of an old TV series. Nobody's ever done anything like that." And it was nothing but rejection. So
Didn't
survival.
One executive throw Little Orphan Annie in your face?
Oh yeah, absolutely, Columbia. He said, "Michael, he goes, Batman will never succeed as a motion picture because our movie Annie didn't do well." And I looked at him and I said, "You mean the little redheaded girl who sings the song Tomorrow?" He says, "Yeah." I go, "Well, what does that have to do with Batman?" He says, "Oh, come on, Michael, they're both out of the funny pages." And that was my rejection from Columbia, topped only by my rejection from my alma mater, United Artists, where the guy there said, "Michael, you're nuts. Batman and Robin would never be successful because the movie Robin and Marion didn't do well." Now, you might remember, Joe, that was a 1979 movie with Sean Connery and Audrey Hepburn about an aging Robin Hood and Maid Marian. So after 10
sure
years
of,
you know, trying to figure out what the hell he had said, truly, because they both had the word Robin
How,
in the title.
What kept you going? Like, why didn't you, like, what kept you going through all that? That had to be the most frustrating thing in the world.
That's an understatement. It's an understatement. So what kept me going? I would say it comes down to two things in particular. Number one, my mom raised me that when you believe in something, you see it through to the end. Or when you make a commitment, you see it through to the end. Case in point, Pee Wee League. I was 8 years old. Our coach used to scream at those of us who would strike out in the game. It was a nightmare for me, and I wanted to quit. My mother said, "Nope, you're going to see it through to the end. I'm sorry. We can talk to the coach and see what we can do, but you made a commitment to your teammates, and that's that." So that's the way I was brought up. Number two, I couldn't have done it without the support of my wife and my family. Everybody was behind me. And it's important, Joe, because when you go through 10 years of virtually everyone telling you you stink, that your work is bad, your ideas are lousy, you've got to really look deep inside yourself and go, okay, is the whole world right and I'm wrong? Am I just being stubborn? or do I absolutely positively believe in this and believe in myself? And I kept coming up with the second answer, and I kept finding ways to hold on by my fingertips. And, of course, in the process, as you know from the book, I did have a guardian angel in the form of my father-in-law who helped me financially through the last 5 months before we were able to get to the finish line.
He gave you a deadline, right? And it was
how close
to the deadline? He'd given you some money, and then it was like, okay, but if this doesn't work, you go back to law school?
I go back to being a lawyer, yeah. He was the wisest man
lawyer, right.
in the world. Yeah, he was the wisest, kindest man in the world.
How close to the deadline was? I'm trying to remember now.
It was that day.
It was day of, right?
Yeah, and everybody in Hollywood that I was dealing with knew about my deadline.
Oh.
So they set it up so the FedEx truck pulled up with the signed contracts and the check for six figures, whereby I was able to pay my father-in-law back and then have enough money that got me through to Batman. Now, my father-in-law, for you Cincinnati folks, it was Dr. Maria Osher, Dr. M.S. Osher, who, with my brother-in-law, Bob Osher, founded the Cincinnati Eye Institute.
Okay. Well, another person we have to thank on this road.
Absolutely.
And have have I mentioned get the book? Get the book. That's all in there. Great stuff.
Joe, if you're looking for roots of this story, part of the roots are in Cincinnati.
Ah, the Buckeye State. Again, mm-hmm. it all springs. Hey, even Superman started here as well, too. One of those little markers along the way that probably kept you going, and we have to mention it here on Comic Book Central because we talked to Adrian Barbeau, Swamp Thing.
Yeah.
I want to throw that in there. I love this movie. I'm not kidding. I love this movie. If this were made in the 30s and it was in black and white, this would be a classic Universal horror film.
That's what we set out to do. We wanted to make a rubber-suited monster movie where the kids could boo at the villain, cheer for the hero, and run to get popcorn when he kissed the girl. And it was so much fun. It was a throwback. We did it. We had $1.9 million to make this movie. It was the first movie I ever produced. I was in my 20s. I was learning on the job. And what first thing I learned is we should have had $19 million to make the movie.
Yeah, Wes Craven thought the same thing, too.
Yeah, oh, totally. But look, everybody's hearts were in the right place. And anyone who was a kid back in 1982 when that movie came out, it has such a fond place in their hearts.
Yep.
I can't even begin to tell you. And it's been extremely successful, thanks largely to Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert. Those guys were amazing. They did five different shows on that movie, talking about it as their buried treasure and their favorite Halloween movie.
Yeah.
And they just were great in helping it become a cult classic.
I love it. I love it. The great, the late great Dick Duroc really brought that to life. So, and that sort of like gave you the confidence, I'm guessing, to bring Batman to the screen. Let's talk about this. 1989, Pittsburgh's own Michael Keaton. I'm from that area. I loved when he was cast as Batman. I thought this was going to be the coolest thing, but you did not think so right off the bat, correct?
No, I was apoplectic.
Okay.
I really was.
Good reason. I mean, he's Mr. Mom.
Yeah, that was my first impression. You know, the fans went nuts. It was the first case of what has become a frequent thing now, a fan outrage. And there was no internet. There was just no internet, no computers back then.
Could you imagine if there had been? You would have blown up the internet.
Yeah, oh, God. I couldn't even imagine it because
Ben Affleck
this came over
bad,
conventional
yeah.
press.
Yeah.
And I thought they were going to surround Warner Brothers with torches and pitchforks. That's really what it came down to. But because I was fanboy in the inner circle and had access, I could ask Tim about it, and he was able to explain his vision for it, which really is the root of his genius. And he said to me, look, he says, you're worried about him not just being a comedian. He's a great actor. And in order to prove that to me, they showed me the rough cut of Clean and Sober. All right, I came back. I said, you're right. He is a great actor. I take it back. But he's my height. Where's the muscles? For God's sake, where's the square jaw that Batman has? And Tim said, you know, going from one medium to another, it's not a square jaw that makes a Batman. He said, I can cheat the height. I can carve musculature into a costume. But in order to be the first truly dark and serious comic book superhero movie, to have an audience accept it and not laugh at it, we need to do two things. He says, number one, we've got to make Gotham City the third most important character in this movie from the opening frames. Number two, once they believe in Gotham City, they must believe in Bruce Wayne. He says, this movie's not about Batman. This movie has got to be about Bruce Wayne. And we need to show a Bruce Wayne so driven, so obsessed, to the point of being psychotic that audiences will buy it and say, yes, that's a guy who would put on a bat suit and go out and fight a guy like the Joker. He said, you got to admit, since we hired Nicholson, we can't go with an unknown actor. Nicholson would wipe the screen with the guy. I agreed. The second point that he made was that with Bruce Wayne, you had to really, really go to the nth degree of showing his quirkiness, of showing the trauma that gave birth to this Batman persona, that was critically important. And he did not know how to show that using what you would call a quote-unquote serious actor circa 87, 88. He was afraid he would get unintentional laughs from the audience.
But yeah, they were looking at Michael like Mel Gibson, Tom Selleck, Kevin Costner, that kind of thing.
Costner, Dennis Quaid, Harrison Ford.
Right.
Those were the stars of the day. And but he knew he could do it with Keaton. And ultimately, he proved everybody else wrong, and he proved that his vision was right, and he knew how to execute.
Well, Keaton had the crazy eyes. And there's a scene where he's as Bruce Wayne, he's going at Napier.
Let's get nuts.
Let's get nuts. And right then, you buy it.
Yep.
You're all in. And it's, it's just perfect. You mentioned Nicholson. What was the casting process like with a star of that magnitude?
Well, this is one of my favorite stories in The Boy Who Loved Batman, because I save everything, and I save the picture that I'm going to tell you about right now. And that was...
it's in there, yeah. I mean, it's you can see it.
Yeah, it was Memorial Weekend 1980, and I get on a bus from New York City, and I get the afternoon paper, the New York Post, and I open it up, and it talks about two new movies opening up that weekend, Empire Strikes Back and a horror film called The Shining. And there is that first shot I get of the Jack Nicholson picture that's become so iconic, the Here's Johnny shot where he looks absolutely maniacal,
busting through
peering
the
around a wall.
Yeah.
And I go, oh, my God, it's the Joker. And I tore it out. As soon as I got home, I ran to my desk. I took white out and whited out Jack's face. I took a red pen and did his lips and a green magic marker and did his hair. And I used that to show everybody associated with the picture from then on why Jack Nicholson was the only actor who could play the Joker. And when he was hired, it was one of the greatest days of my career.
Oh, that was, it just took it to another level, too. How important was it to give the Joker a backstory? Didn't really have one in the comic books up to that point, not much of one.
Well, yeah, no, he did. He had the thing about falling into the vat of acid.
The history, you kind of like, you gave him a name. We got Jack Napier.
Well, yeah, they gave him a name. One of the big points that of controversy that I had with Tim and some of the others was his shooting Batman's parents.
Mm-hmm.
Because in the comics that I was used to, it was Joe Chill, just the thug.
Right.
And there were two things we did to settle this issue. One was Tim wound up putting two guys in the scene. So for the crazy fans like me, I could say, oh, there's Joe Chill.
Mm-hmm.
but he was still able to do it with Nicholson. I went to Bob Kane, and I said, Bob, what do you think of this? I need to know your opinion. And Bob said, if we had created the Joker at the inception of Batman, he said, this would have been an even better idea to use it for the origin. So he goes, I'm all for it. And that was good for me to hear.
Signed off, yeah, signed off by Batman's co-creator along with Bill Finger. We talked about Anton. Well, we haven't talked about Anton First yet. He won the Academy Award for set
design. Yeah, we were
design.
With him that night. it was one of the great nights.
Talk about what he brought to this project, because we're so used to CGI and CGI sets and everything built in computers and everything. These sets were unreal.
The sets were amazing. Ben Melnicker and I walked the sets at Pinewood Studios together. And you have to understand that Ben, who started at MGM in 1939, one of the pictures that he had put together, the deals he had put together, was Ben-Hur. And Ben said to me, Michael, I never, ever thought in my life I would ever see sets more impressive than the sets of Ben-Hur. He goes, but this does it. This is bigger and more spectacular than the sets we had for Ben-Hur. So that gives you an idea. It was like five square city blocks. And my kids, who were 4 and 8 at the time, were taken for a ride in a Batmobile throughout Gotham City. They still talk about it. It was incredible what Anton did. There was only one line in Sam Hamm's script that described Gotham City. It said, Gotham City is as if hell has erupted from under the ground. And Anton went to Tim and goes, what does this mean? And Tim thought about it and said, I think it means New York City had there never been planning and zoning. All covered in a layer of industrial age rust. Anton goes, I get that. Goes off, researches it, comes up with conflicting styles of architecture, a lot of Japanese, as I recall, and waltzes in with the plans for Gotham City, the design of the Batmobile, the whole look of the picture. The man was one of the most creative geniuses that I have ever met and was proud to call my friend.
To this day, still my favorite Gotham City look. Danny Elfman with the score, Prince with the soundtrack. Talk about the music a little bit.
Well, the Danny Elfman soundtrack, we've been doing a number of screenings of the first movie now for the 25th anniversary, and I hadn't seen it in a long time, actually. So I saw it again recently a few times, and you know what? I still get the chills. And the scenes that give me the chills, I got to give credit to Danny Elfman, because it's the theme song for the opening. Over the credits, where you're going through this stone labyrinth, you have no idea what you're seeing or what you're doing until it pulls back and you realize you've gone through the logo. That was incredible. The scene of the Batmobile, driving the Batmobile through the night, through the woods and everything, and the back roads with Vicki Vale, and that music, chills. At the end, as the camera starts to pan up and he's on top of the skyscraper looking out over the bat signal, I'm getting the chills now, just talking about it.
I'm getting the chills. I'm watching it after we hang up here.
I'm telling you.
I'm putting the Blu-ray in.
And if you want to talk about signature scenes, when Michael Keaton first appears vampirically on the roof of that building and grabs the bad guy and holds him over the ledge, and it's two words, I'm Batman, and then he jumps and disappears, all of those scenes give me the chills. This was my dream come true. And that's probably the best way that I can sum it all up.
That had to be mind-blowing after a 10-year wait like that. Well, I mean, even since you were a little kid, to be able to see that. And then how cool was it to have Prince on the soundtrack? Nicholson seems to be having fun with that, too.
That's true. When you dealt with the studios back then, and they owned the major record labels, they were always advocating that their top stars or the acts they were looking to really break be used. So that was a common practice back then. And, I love how Tim made it work.
But it fits. It fits the movie because you've got Prince in purple and the Joker is in purple. So, I mean, a lot of it just fit, even from a color scheme, aesthetically. Musically, I think it just all fit together. It was like the perfect storm of everything happening all at once.
Yeah, it really did. And in conclusion, in commenting about it, I would say that Tim's vision to make the movie in a way that was timeless. It's not the present, but it's not the past. It's not the future. It's an amalgam. As I've gone around the country and talked about it ever since then, I've asked audiences, do you think this was set in the past, present, or future? And you get a third, a third, and a third everywhere you go. And it was that combination of everything that gives a timeless quality to it. So when you look at it now, you don't say, gee, this was a 1980s movie. The movie really stands up very well. And that's a cool part of it.
Yeah, I feel it's in the 40s. When I watch it, I feel it's in the 40s. That's kind of how I like that. DVD and Blu-ray extras, they abound regarding the making of these films. I'd like to play just a little free association with the Batman franchise, just to get your overall thoughts. 1992, Batman Returns, and so does Michael Keaton. Thoughts on Batman Returns?
Love Michelle Pfeiffer as Catwoman. Danny DeVito, who's a friend, I was picturing that they were going to do Danny DeVito as Burgess Meredith, kind of doing that, and then Tim took it.
You mean
it
complete
much,
with the?
Much,
wah, wah, I mean, like with the sound.
Well,
and
kind of taking it to the nth degree in a dark way,
Comic,
and then Tim's really surprised me by going very, very dark with the Penguin. A lot of people really find this to be the darkest Batman of all and find great enjoyment out of it in terms of its the depth of the darkness to it.
I find it to be the darkest of all of the Batman movies myself. 1995, Joel Schumacher comes in to direct Batman Forever, with Val Kilmer taking over the lead role, Chris O'Donnell coming in as Robin, Tommy Lee Jones as Harvey Dent, Two-Face, and Jim Carrey as the Riddler. Thoughts on Batman Forever?
Joel Schumacher is one of the nicest people you will ever want to meet, a real gentleman.
I like the movie. I love Jim Carrey in it. I think Tommy Lee's a little bit over the top, but again, it's a, you know, it's a comic book. But I don't know. I like the movie. Are you just kind of okay on it?
I'm okay on it. It's definitely lighter, brighter, more kiddie friendly, more family friendly, more merchandising friendly.
Yeah, we're selling toys at this point. Full on selling toys with 1997's Batman and Robin. With George Clooney, ER's George Clooney taking over the role, and Ice to See You with Arnold Schwarzenegger. Look, I kind of have gone back over this film, and I look at it as an homage to the old Batman TV series. I kind of like if an updating of that.
Yeah, if you treasure the Batman TV series, it's a wonderful homage to it.
I do, and yeah.
George Clooney, one of the nicest guys I've met at the premiere. We sat with him and his dad and talked about Grater's Ice Cream and Montgomery Ribs and Skyline Chili.
Yeah, I had a chance to interview his dad right before the movie came out, and he says, you know, hey, George was running around the house in his Batman pajamas all the time. He was pretending he was Batman.
They're so, great people.
How do you, I mean, so as a producer, what can you do at that point when the machinery starts to head more toward merchandising than toward your original vision?
Well, generally in the industry, you're dealing now with companies that are no longer simply movie studios. They're kind of international conglomerates. A lot of wheels to be greased. A lot of companies get run. And sometimes, and I'm not talking about Batman now, I'm just talking generally in the motion picture industry, you have executives who become very fixated on merchandising and toys and games and licensing. And somebody on the filmmaking side, I feel that's kind of the tail wagging the dog. And when that happens and there's an insistence that to satisfy all the licensees, there should be, each character should have two vehicles and two costume changers, and you need a minimum of three good guys or three bad guys, you know, you suddenly come up with stuff that is too merchandise-driven, and there's no room for plot, tone, character development, and I think everything suffers as a result of that kind of thinking. We've been very, very lucky with the management at Warner Brothers to give the keys to the castle to Chris Nolan and let him restore the darkness and dignity to Batman and give him free reign as a filmmaker who then was able to elevate. I really think he has elevated the comic book movie. He has brought it to a different level. When you see one of Chris's movies, another genius, I might add, you can walk out of a movie and you don't have to say, that was a great comic book movie. You can now say, that was a great film.
That was a great film.
That's huge.
And an Academy Award-winning performance for Heath Ledger. I love Nicholson. Heath Ledger, my goodness. My goodness in this role. What did you think when you first saw it?
Blown away. You know, once again, Chris Nolan does the unusual, does the unexpected, finds a way to show Batman seriously but realistically with a Gotham City that feels like a real city, with Bruce Wayne that feels like a real human being who's been traumatized on a personal lost horizon journey through life. When he makes you believe in that this technology could all be real, and when he makes you believe the Joker in this not black and white, good versus evil comic book world, but in the world in which we live today, a gray world of order versus chaos, could truly exist as a madman, as a homicidal maniac, as a modern-day terrorist who places no value on human life whatsoever, not man, woman, or child. That's scary, that's too real, and it's amazing what he pulled off.
Yeah,
and the thematic importance of what he pulled off regarding 9/11 and post 9/11 was really incredible.
Yeah, I'm transfixed when I watch his performance. It's simply amazing. Who is your favorite Batman, and why?
Wrong question. It's all about who's your favorite Bruce Wayne.
Oh, okay. Interesting take.
The Batmans are not all that different. There's a range, but they're not all that different. The Bruce Waynes are totally, totally different. I think Michael Keaton, we wouldn't have had success if he didn't play Bruce Wayne the original out-of-the-box thinking way that he did under Tim's guidance. I think that Christian Bale nails Bruce Wayne for every generation of Batman fan, no matter what you were exposed to. He is Bruce Wayne, and you believe him as Bruce Wayne. So, you know, I just think it's been a terrific journey.
Michael Keaton. I got to go with Michael Keaton. Speed round for Michael Uslan. Are you ready?
Yeah.
Batman v. Superman, Dawn of Justice. Can you tell us anything? Give us a little hint. Drop something. Anything.
All I can say is I am excited about it. I'm excited about Ben Affleck being Bruce Wayne in his mid-40s. I'm excited every time you have a filmmaker and people involved who are fans, who clearly love the character, have a passion for the character, have a vision for the character, and you know they know how to execute a vision.
Are you going back to your legal days with the V?
Talk to the Vendetta guys when it comes to V.
For Vendetta. Justice League. What's Affleck going to do?
Who knows what's lurking beyond Batman versus Superman? I don't look that far into the future.
Can you give us what have you seen on Justice League? Can you tell us that? How much of it have you kind of been peering into?
I just look backwards to Brave and Bold 28, 29, 30, my Justice League collection, how much it turned me on as a kid, how exciting it was to see my superheroes beyond just the Superman, Batman, world's finest stuff, get together, work together against great villains, many of which are brand new and cosmic. It was a wonderful, wonderful thing when Justice League came into my life as a kid, and I collected it voraciously. With that kind of excitement, you know it's going to continue to excite people all over the world for generations. Very happy about Justice League.
And we're scrambling through our long boxes to look through those. Maybe you dropped a hint in there somewhere. Shazam, July 2016. Am I hearing this right?
I have no idea.
You've got a Shazam. There's something out there. Come on, a little holy moly. When are we going
Shazam
to see?
Shazam for me is a magic word. The character for me is Captain Marvel. I was a huge Captain Marvel fan. I was close to both Otto Binder and C.C. Beck, who were the driving creative forces of Captain Marvel throughout the 1940s and 50s. And that character means so much to me. And the idea of a boy of 12 or so having a magic word and turns into an adult superhero, but still has the kind of vision and sensibilities of a 12-year-old boy. There's something very Harry Potterish about it, something very magical about it, obviously. And I think it's great and a complete opposite from Superman.
Are we going to see Captain Marvel on the big screen?
Let's wait together and see what happens. Back in 1940?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And I still love it. I love that old series. The Doc Savage movie. Chris Hemsworth, what do you think of him? He's pretty good as Thor.
There are any number of, I think, great actors who could do a great job with Doc Savage, especially a young Doc Savage emerging. And I'm thrilled. Shane Black is incredible and a Doc Savage fan from day one. Everybody involved in the picture are just huge fans and very excited. So stay tuned.
Have you had lunch with Chris Hemsworth?
More importantly, are you available for lunch at Skyline? That's the question.
And I want to wrap it up with Justice Incorporated, Dynamite Comics. You are writing comic books. You're still writing comic books. Speaking of Doc Savage, it's Doc Savage, The Shadow, and The Avenger. Pulp Comics coming back. This is hitting stands now, correct?
Yeah, it'll be out in August. I'm having so much fun with it. I just finished writing the graphic novel, The Shadow Meets the Green Hornet, Dark Knights. And it was the first official meeting between the Shadow and the Green Hornet, two characters I used to listen to the reruns of on radio. That was very important to me, as is Justice Incorporated. Can you imagine a pulp company and a comic book company that have these three great superheroes, and in 75 years they never put them together in one adventure? It's unreal. And so this is historic, and I get to play with these three great characters. Doc Savage, who was the primary inspiration to Siegel and Schuster in the creation of Superman. The Shadow, who was the direct inspiration to Bill Finger and with Bob Kane on Batman. And the Avenger, who's been an inspiration to everything called the Avengers. So this is a unique opportunity. And in fact, let's keep in mind that Doc Savage's first name is Clark, and the Shadow's first name is Kent.
So, yes, it is.
That kind of sums up the influence these guys have had.
They have been brought back, thanks to Michael Uslan, Giovanni Timpano on art, and covers by the great Alex Ross. Those are going to be some great books. How can fans find out more about you? Website, Facebook, Twitter? Where is Michael Uslan?
You'll find me on Facebook. I'll be at San Diego Comic-Con. I'm doing, I think, three Batman panels and an Archie panel, because not only did I write Archie Gets Married a couple of years ago, but I am now writing a new Archie story, which will begin in August, and it is called Farewell Betty and Veronica. And I am getting the girls, they are leaving Riverdale, and we're going to change the entire dynamics of Archie Comics in Riverdale.
And you're headed to China for the first Comic-Con?
I'm heading to Thailand for its first Comic-Con.
For Thailand?
Yeah, in Bangkok. And then from there, it's on to Beijing and Shanghai for a lot of interesting new doings in Asia. China is the most fascinating market. It's changing rapidly, and it's going to have a great impact on the future of the motion picture and television business. And I am somebody who really likes to try to stay current and look ahead rather than always look behind.
The book is The Boy Who Loved Batman. The comic book is Justice Incorporated. The author is Michael Uslan. Michael, without you and your team, we would not have the Bat Universe that we have today. You continue to bring comic books to life in a big, big way. For that, we thank you. And I thank you for joining me here on Comic Book Central today.
Thanks, Joe. This was a real pleasure.
Michael Uslan is the man. I have to have him back on the show sometime soon. Didn't even get to touch on all of the Batman animated films that he's executive produced, not to mention Catwoman, the Lego Movie, Constantine, The Spirit. The list just goes on and on and on. So, like I said, I could do several parts, feature series on Michael Uslan. And as of this airing, he is back from Asia, back from a whirlwind weekend at San Diego Comic-Con. And he's ready to move into Batman versus Superman and all the other projects we discussed. So looking forward to hearing more about those in the months and years ahead. To find out all about Michael's comings and goings, his appearances and projects, give him a like on Facebook, facebook.com, The Michael Uslan. The book is The Boy Who Loved Batman, a memoir. Great deals on Amazon. You can also get it on chroniclebooks.com. Less than 10 bucks for a Kindle version on Amazon as well, too. So you can't beat some of those deals. And be sure to head into your local comic book store August 20th. That is going to be a big day for Michael Uslan fans as Justice Inc. Issue 1 hits the shelves alongside Betty and Veronica, Issue 272, Goodbye Betty and Veronica. We've got the both ends of the spectrum, the comic book spectrum there. Go pick up those issues, enjoy some Michael Uslan comic booky goodness, and tell them Comic Book Central sent you. And a big happy 75th anniversary to Batman. The celebration is going to continue all year long here in the Lair. We've got some great Bat guests coming up. And happy 25th anniversary to Michael, his team, and Batman the movie. Thank you again, Michael, for your perseverance in bringing the Dark Knight to the screen. Don't forget Comic Book Central Nation, Connecticut Comic Con, August 15th through the 17th. I'm looking forward to taking the show on the road. You can find out more online at comiconwith2ns.com. And you can find Comic Book Central online, the website, comicbookcentral.net. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes so you won't miss an episode. I thank you for spending an hour with me here in the Lair today. If you can spare one more minute, I'd appreciate it if you'd post a review in iTunes. It is very helpful. So if you can just take a minute, post a review if you like the show. Really appreciate it. You can also share The Lair on Twitter and Facebook. Hashtag share the lair at facebook.com/comicbookcentralnetwork. and Twitter at ComicBookCTRL. And be sure to drop me a line, joe@comicbookcentral.net. I want to hear all of your questions for William Catt, Ray Park, Maximiliano Hernandez, the cast of Thundercats. Send them along. I'll try to work them in at the convention and bring those all back to you in the weeks ahead. Well, folks, like Batman wrapping up a conversation with Commissioner Gordon, I am going to disappear for now. But I will return when the Comic Book Central signal shines once more. In fact, next week on Comic Book Central, I will be teaming up with the Sentinel of Liberty, the Star-Spangled Avenger himself. Television's original Captain America, Reb Brown, will be here to talk about the CBS movies, Super Soldier Serum, and Slinging the Shield. Until then, have a bat-tastic week. Keep reading those comics. Thanks for joining me here in the lair. Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life. This podcast is intended for entertainment and education purposes only. All original content of this podcast is the intellectual property of Comic Book Central and is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivations 3.0 Unported License. All other content and names are registered trademarks and copyrights of the respective holders. There's so much talk. I didn't even get into the spirit. My goodness. Love that movie. I love that movie, too. I know people dog on it, but, man, it's a comic book. Figure it out, guys.
We will do that in the next episode.